The Copyright Extension Gambit, 1904 to 1909. When Olivia died suddenly on the 5th of June 1904, Clemens's interest in his autobiography quite naturally evaporated. And in the next year and a half, he wrote only one short sketch for it, Anecdote of Jean. But before Olivia died, his new enthusiasm for dictating the autobiography gave rise to a scheme to provide income for the family he thought would survive him. He was then 68. In the same January letter to Howells in which he enthused about dictation, he described this new idea. If I live 2 years, this auto will cover many volumes, but they will not be published independently, but only as notes, copyrightable, to my existing books. Their purpose is to add 28 years to the life of the existing books. I think the notes will add 50% of matter to each book and be some shades more readable than the book itself. This notion was still alive almost a year after Clemens had begun his dictations to Josephine Hobby in January 1906. In December of that year, he spoke of it to a reporter, who then summarized it in the New York Times. As soon as the copyright expires on one of his books, Mark Twain or his executors will apply for a new copyright on the book with a portion of the autobiography run as a footnote. For example, when the copyright on Tom Sawyer expires, a new edition of that book will be published. About one-third of this new edition of Tom Sawyer will be autobiography, separated from the old text only by the rules or lines. The same course will be followed with each book as the copyright expires. So far as possible, the part of the autobiography will be germane to the book in which it appears. He is confirmed in this by the experience of Sir Walter Scott, from whom he got the germ of his idea. Scott kept his copyrights alive by publishing new editions with commentaries. He believes his scheme will ensure a copyright of 84 years instead of 42, and as he said the other day, the children are all I am interested in. Let the grandchildren look out for themselves. It is difficult to know just how serious Clemens was about this scheme because it was never put to the test. On the 24th of December, 1909, in Closing Words of My Autobiography, he explained that the reason that moved me was a desire to save my copyrights from extinction, so that Jean and Clara would always have a good livelihood from my books after my death. That tedious long labor was wasted. Last March, Congress added 14 years to the 42 term, and so my oldest book has now about 15 years to live. I have no use for that edition. I am 74 years old. Poor Jean has no use for it now. Clara is happily and prosperously married and has no use for it. Because of that change in the law, he evidently told Clara much the same thing. She protested, and he replied on the 23rd of February, 1909, "Maybe I ought to have said half-wasted. Bless your heart, I put in 2 or 3 years on that autobiography in order to add 28 years to my book lives. Congress has now gone and added 14 of the 28, and the law is now in such a sane shape that Congress can be persuaded presently, without difficulty, to add another 14. My child, I wasn't doing the autobiography in the world's interest, but only in yours and Jean's." Still, it is clear that extending his copyrights had never been his primary motive for creating the autobiography. Autobiography of Mark Twain. The autobiographical dictations begin, January 1906. Clemens, his two daughters, Katie Leary and Isabel Lyon, accompanied Olivia's body back to America in July 1904. They buried her at Quarry Farm, and Clara entered a rest home in New York City while Clemens, Jean, and Lyon spent the rest of the month in a rented summer home in Lee, Massachusetts. On the 10th of August, Clemens went to New York and soon signed a 3-year lease for a townhouse at 21 Fifth Avenue, which he and Jean occupied in December 1904 after it was renovated and furnished. 1 year later, in January 1906, work on the autobiography had been at a standstill for 18 months. A catalyst was needed to revive the enthusiasm of 1904, and on the night of the 3rd of January, it arrived in the form of Albert Bigelow Payne. Payne was an experienced writer and editor who in 1904 had published a biography of Thomas Nast, which Clemens admired. On that January evening, Payne attended a dinner in honor of Clemens, hosted by the Players Club, and happened to be seated nearly facing him. 3 days later, he called at 21 Fifth Avenue and asked to write Mark Twain's biography. After brief preliminaries, Clemens turned to him and said, "When would you like to begin?" Payne went on to suggest that a stenographer be hired to take notes of what Clemens said in response to the biographer's questions. Clemens said that he thought he would enjoy dictating to a stenographer with someone to prompt me and to act as audience, and he offered Payne office room and access to a trunk full or two of his manuscripts, notes, and letters. "Whatever you need will be brought to you. We can have the dictation here in the morning, and you can put in the rest of the day to suit yourself. You can have a key and come and go as you please." It was agreed that work should begin on the 9th of January. On that Saturday morning, Payne arrived accompanied by a stenographer, Josephine S. Hobby. The procedure for working on the biography was promptly decided, but Clemens proposed to double the value and interest of our employment by letting his dictations continue the form of those earlier autobiographical chapters, begun with Redpath in 1885 and continued later in Vienna and at the Villa Quarto. He said he did not think he could follow a definite chronological program, that he would like to wander about, picking up this point and that as memory or fancy prompted, without any particular biographical order. It was his purpose, he declared, that his dictations should not be published until he had been dead 100 years or more, a prospect which seemed to give him an especial gratification. Josephine Hobby was an experienced stenographer and an excellent typist, known to Payne for about 8 years. She had previously worked for Charles Dudley Warner and Mary Mapes Dodge and was currently employed by the Century Company, which since 1899 had also employed Payne as an editor of St. Nicholas, a magazine for young people. Hobby charged $1 per hour of dictation and 5 cents per 100 words of typescript. She began immediately with a transcription of the morning's conversation. "We will try this," Clemens told Payne, "see whether it is dull or interesting, or whether it will bore us and we will want to commit suicide. I hate to get at it, I hate to begin, but I imagine that if you are here to make suggestions from time to time, we can make it go along instead of having it drag." He proposed to schedule a 4 or 5 days a week for roughly 2 hours each morning. Clemens talked while Hobby took him down in shorthand, and Payne listened appreciatively. For these early sessions, Payne recalled, Clemens usually dictated from bed, clad in a handsome silk dressing gown of rich Persian pattern, propped against great snowy pillows. Before Clemens was done dictating in 1909, he and Hobby, along with 3 other typists, generated more than 5,000 pages of typescript. That enormous body of material has, since Clemens's death, constituted the largest part of the manuscript known as the autobiography. But probably since DeVoto's time as editor of the Mark Twain papers, anyone who consulted that file was likely to be puzzled by 2 things. First, most of the autobiographical dictations between January and August 1906 were filed in folders, 1 per dictation, containing between 2 and 4 separate, distinct, typed copies of essentially the same text. No one understood the purpose of the duplicates. Second, the differences, if any, between these various duplicates were not obvious or readily intelligible. Pagination differed, seemingly without pattern. Some contained handwritten authorial revisions, while others were unmarked, and many were extensively marked by at least 6 different, mostly unidentified, hands, in addition to the author's. These documents constituted the central puzzle confronting anyone who set out to publish the autobiography of Mark Twain. The first typescript, TS1. A first step in solving the puzzle was to find reliable ways of distinguishing between the several nearly identical typed copies in any given folder. The paper used, specific characteristics of the typewriter and habits of the typist, and of course the unexplained differences in pagination, proved to be essential pieces of evidence. The very first typescript Hobby created from her stenographic notes was eventually isolated and identified in this way, and it is called hereafter TS1, for typescript 1. Each of the other typescripts, sometimes with carbon copies as well, were similarly identified and are herein referred to by number, TS2, TS3, and TS4. Once they were physically distinguishable in this way, it became possible to see that the understandable fashion in which daily dictations were filed had in fact long obscured why there were different typed copies. It was in turn possible to decide, on the basis of meticulous collation, which was copied from which, and to begin to make some sense of the various differences between them. By the 18th of January, Hobby had settled on a standard format for each session. She recorded the time spent on dictation and a word count at the top left of the first page, with the page number centered, and the date of dictation at the right, usually followed by a summary of the contents. Hobby marked in pencil any errors she had failed to correct on the machine. The typescript then went to Clemens for correction and revision. TS-1 would total roughly 2,600 consecutively numbered pages, beginning at page 1 with the dictation of the 9th of January, 1906, and ending with the dictation of the 14th of July, 1908, which Hobby completed shortly before leaving Clemens's employment. Two later stenographer typists produced another 100 or so pages of typescript, which did not continue the TS-1 pagination sequence. Hobby soon agreed to give up her job with the Century Company in order to work for Clemens exclusively during the summer, and possibly longer. On the 13th of March, Lyon commented in her journal, "Mr. Clemens finds her entirely to his liking, and he says it is a case of established competency, which is saying a great deal, for she is a good audience, is sympathetic, and very appreciative." By the 8th of April, Hobby had transcribed her notes through the end of the 28th of March, 1906 dictation. Despite the risk of somehow losing TS-1, a unique copy, there was no carbon copy at this point, Clemens allowed Clara to carry away and read about 500 pages through the end of the 16th of March dictation. He also lent Twitchell 3 days' dictation, probably those for the 23rd, 26th, and 27th of March. On the 8th of April, Lyon recorded that Mr. Twitchell is here, Mrs. Too, and Mr. T. thinks the auto MS is absorbingly interesting. He presumably returned the 3 dictations at that time. The same day, Clemens took the entire 28th of March dictation, Orion's Misadventure with Dr. Meredith's Old Maid Sisters, up to lunch with Howells at the Hotel Regent. Howells returned the pages by the next day's mail. "I want to see every word of the 578 pages before this, which is one of the humanest and richest pages in the history of man. If you have gone this gate all through, you have already gone farther than any autobiographer ever went before. You are nakeder than Adam and Eve put together, and truer than sin. But, you really mustn't let Orion have got into the bed." "I know he did, but..." Lyon noted that Clara had written enthusiastically about it too, but her letter has not been found. Clemens replied to her in Atlantic City 2 days before she was supposed to return the pages to him. "I am so glad, you dear Ashcat, so glad the auto interests you. I was so afraid it wouldn't. I couldn't guess as to how it might read, for I have purposely refrained from reading a line of it myself, lest I should find myself disappointed and throw up the job. I wanted it to gather age before I should look at it, so that it would read to me as it would to a stranger. Then I could judge it intelligently. However, as Twitchell wanted to experiment with it, I took the last 3 days' installments and corrected them. And in this way I found out that I was doing well enough for an apprentice who was an unpracticed learner in the art of dictating to a stenographer. Twitchell's verdict is that the interest doesn't flag. That's all I want. I only want to interest the reader. He can go elsewhere for profit and instruction." On the 11th of April, Clemens took a break from his dictating routine and did not resume until the 21st of May, after he, Jean, and Lyon were settled for the summer in the isolated Upton House near the village of Dublin, New Hampshire. Clemens arrived there on the 15th of May. Payne and Hobby arrived a few days later and found quarters nearby. Payne reported, "We began in his bedroom as before, but the feeling there was depressing." He described the view from the veranda of the Upton House as one of the most beautiful landscape visions on the planet, and reported that Clemens soon saw the opportunity it presented. "I think we'll do our dictating out here hereafter. It ought to be an inspiring place." Lyon occasionally recorded Clemens's and her own impatience with the old maidish whims and slowness of the hobby horse, but for the most part the morning sessions seemed to have been remarkably amicable. Lyon described one of them in her journal. "There was a 3-hour dictation this morning, when Mr. Clemens used letters as a subject. It was beautiful to hear their laughter from the porch. The king's rich laugh, the biographer's falsetto delight, and the stenographer's chirping gurgle. It made a lovely song, crossed out. I stole out to sit on a wicker thing in the hall and watch and listen. The king in white, the biographer in soft gray, and the stenographer in dark blue with a kitten in her lap. In late May, Clemens also began in earnest the job of reading and correcting the 4 months' accumulation of TS1, which by then consisted of over 700 pages, through the dictation for the 11th of April. He revised the typescript in black ink, only rarely in pencil, making relatively few changes in wording, at least after the first 10 dictations, and he consistently made a smattering of changes or corrections to spelling, punctuation, and paragraphing. For the most part, Hobby seems to have learned, directly or indirectly from Clemens, how he preferred to spell and punctuate. Inevitably, there were mistakes, especially in proper names, K-A-T-I-E for Katie instead of K-A-T-Y, Susie, S-U-S-I-E instead of the preferred S-U-S-Y, Twitchell, T-W-I-T-C-H-E-L-L instead of T-W-I-C-H-E-L-L. And with a backlog of hundreds of pages typed before he began his review, Clemens invariably found repetitive errors. Lyon noted in her journal, "Day after day, Mr. Clemens is harassed and tormented when he is reading the dictated matter by continually coming across Hobby blunders, and the worst one, the most exasperating one, is where she invariably corrects Mr. Clemens, writing 1,000 or 100, where he has said 1,000 or 100. Today it passed the limit of his endurance. Through his tightly shut teeth, he damned that hell-fired word until he was tired, and then he went for that idiot. That devilish woman. I'd like someone to take her out and have her scalped and gutted." He had found and corrected over 24 instances of this trivial but irritating error. One can only hope that he alerted Hobby to her mistake in a less ferocious mood. S.S. McClure and Syndication. Clemens's correction and revision of TS1 was given a special impetus by S.S. McClure, founder of McClure's Syndicate and McClure's Magazine, who offered to pay Clemens $1 per word for the right to syndicate 50,000 words from the autobiography. As Clemens reviewed Hobby's typescripts and some of his pre-1906 texts, he began noting likely candidates for McClure's proposed syndication. For instance, the blue-penciled notation M superscript C is written at the top of the first page of the 1904 Villadi Quarto typescript, and the same or a similar notation can be seen on several other pages of TS1 prepared between January and March 1906. Still other dictations were marked not for MC. Clemens was not, however, free to accept McClure's bid. He had signed an exclusive contract with Harper & Brothers on the 22nd of October 1903, which prohibited his publishing with another firm any of his books, writings, or works now existing or which may hereafter be created. It further stipulated that all miscellaneous articles accepted for magazines or periodicals shall be paid for at the rate of 30 cents a word. Even so, on the 27th of May, Clemens kept Lyon busy for 2 hours taking notes while he outlined a course of action to be followed out in his scheme of breaking away from the Harper contract and selling 50,000 words to McClure for $50,000. To be syndicated. His interest in publishing with McClure was more than financial, however. He had an express desire to see the selections go into the papers, even into the Hearst papers, to reach his submerged clientele. He further explained to Rogers, "I'd like to see a lot of this stuff in print before I die, but not the bulk of it, oh no. I am not desiring to be crucified yet. Howells thinks the auto will outlive the Innocents Abroad 1,000 years, and I know it will. I would like the literary world to see, as Howells says, that the form of this book is one of the most memorable literary inventions of the ages. And so it is. It ranks with the steam engine, the printing press, and the electric telegraph. I'm the only person who has ever found out the right way to build an autobiography." Rogers, however, did not favor accepting McClure's offer, believing that the Harper contract was so valuable that they would seize the opportunity of breaking the arrangement if it were possible, he urged Clemens not to think of anything that will vitiate it, The Final and Right Plan, June 1906. On the 10th of June, Clemens wrote to a friend, "I've stopped dictating, tired of it. I've stopped reading autobiography and admiring it, tired to death of it." Clemens's lack of enthusiasm must have been merely a passing mood, however, since he did not, in fact, stop dictating or reading autobiography. From the 11th to the 14th of June, he dictated every day, as well as on 6 more days before the end of the month. While he continued to read and revise TS-1, working his way through the backlog of over 900 pages by the 21st of June. And it was also at this time that he decided to return to a task that he had begun the previous winter but suspended in May. Reviewing his earlier manuscripts, including his preliminary attempts at autobiography. On the 8th of June, he sent Payne to the house at 21 Fifth Avenue to fetch the cache of manuscripts that he had gathered together for use in the biography, as well as for his copyright scheme. Many years later, Lyon annotated a copy of Payne's edition where The Tennessee Land began, explaining that in the winter of 1905-6, Clemens pursued his idea of using autobiographical notes to be added to each volume on its copyright expiration, thus creating a new volume with its new copyright to be extended for 14 years. He asked me for the notes he wrote in 1870 and later, and here is the beginning. It is also likely that at about the same time she heard Clemens read the manuscript of what Payne titled Early Years in Florida, Missouri. She noted in Payne's edition, "Mr. Clemens called for this MS, which he read aloud to me, often deeply moved by memories, his voice momentarily lost in emotion." Payne arrived back in Dublin on the 13th with a small steamer trunk of manuscripts. On the 22nd of June, Lyon wrote in her journal, "And then after luncheon we sat on the porch, and Mr. Clemens read the very first autobiography beginning, a bit, crossed out, written many years ago, about 1879, 44 typewritten pages, and telling of his boyhood days and the farm, and the joys of living in it, crossed out. It is a beautiful bit of poetry. It is full of pictures, and the afternoon was very, very lovely," crossed out. He was deeply moved as he read on and on. Clemens may have been considering which of his early reminiscences he liked well enough to add to the autobiography, if only to enlarge its bulk. A few days earlier, the 17th of June, he had written a long letter to Howells in which he referred to yet another way to expand his text, this one taking advantage of posthumous publication. "There's a good deal of fat. I've dictated, from January 9th, 210,000 words, and the fat adds about 50,000 more. The fat is old pigeonholed things of the years gone by, which I or editors didn't dast to print. For instance, I am dumping in the little old book which I read to you in Hartford about 30 years ago, and which you said, 'Publish, and ask Dean Stanley to furnish an introduction, he'll do it.'" Captain Stormfield's Visit to Heaven. "It reads quite to suit me, without altering a word, now that it isn't to see print until I am dead." And in a postscript he added, "I've written a short preface. I like the title of it, Spoken from the Grave. It will prepare the reader for the solemnities within." The manuscript of this preface, whose subtitle is As from the Grave, and a draft of the title page, survive in the Mark Twain papers, as does a typed copy of the title page on which Clemens drafted a series of notes specifying restrictions and conditions for publishing the autobiography. He then decided to add to his short preface by enlarging on these notes. Addressing his editors, heirs, and assigns, he dwelt at facetious length on how successive editions could include more and more of his supposedly shocking sound and sane expressions of opinion. It is now clear that by the time Clemens read aloud the 44 typewritten pages telling of his boyhood days and the farm on the 22nd of June, he had already decided to use that sketch to begin the autobiography. He wrote a one-page preface called An Early Attempt to introduce it, then followed that with a single-page instruction, "Here insert the 44 old typewritten pages." This old typescript has been lost, but we now know that it was a typed copy of the manuscript he called My Autobiography, Random Extracts from It, written in Vienna in 1897-98. It is not known when this now-missing typescript was prepared, but it was probably no later than 1900. At about the same time, he also decided to further illustrate the evolution of his ideas about autobiography by including some of the dictations produced in Florence in 1904. To frame these, he wrote a matching preface called The Latest Attempt, characterizing them as examples of the right way to do an autobiography. And he made one more change, adding the final and right plan and an epigraph. What a wee little part of a person's life. The result was a three-part preface, concluding with the preface as from the grave, divided into three sections, followed by the introductory note, Here begin the Florentine dictations. The present edition prints this extensive front matter, complete and in the sequence that Clemens intended, for the first time. All of the material was known to Paine, his penciled page numbers are on the manuscript pages, but he apparently realized that it interfered with his own plan for the autobiography, a sequence of early sketches and the Florentine dictations in the order of their composition, followed by a selection of the autobiographical dictations from January through April 1906. He included the epigraph and the first section of As From the Grave at the beginning of his first volume, placing The Latest Attempt before the Florentine dictations, but calling it Author's Note. He omitted entirely an early attempt and the second and third sections of Preface as from the Grave. The prefatory pages, all in the Mark Twain papers, can be found at www.marktwainproject.org and at www.blackstoneaudio.com on the product description page. Since the 44 old typewritten pages are admittedly lost, how can we be sure that they were in fact a copy of My Autobiography, random extracts from it? And how can we tell which of the six surviving Florentine dictations were intended to follow As From the Grave? The multiple typescripts of the January to August 1906 dictations hold the answer to both questions. Two more typescripts, TS2 and TS4. In his postscript to the 17th of June letter to Howells, Clemens had said, I think Miss Lyon told you the reason we couldn't send you the autobiography. There's only one typed copy, and we had to have it for reference to guard against repetitions. The making of a second copy has now begun, and so we can presently begin to mail batches of it to you. TS1 had been begun without any provision for a carbon copy, but Howells and Twitchell's interest in seeing the text earlier in April, and McClure's interest in late May made it increasingly clear that duplicates were vitally needed, hence the decision to begin a carbon copy of TS1 from that point, certainly no later than the 11th of June. But that still left more than 800 pages of dictation in a unique copy, much of which had been revised. Clemens's postscript shows that by the 17th of June, a second copy had been commissioned. In fact, not one, but two typed copies of TS1 were begun in mid to late June, soon after the various prefaces had been created. The first, typed by Hobby, TS2, and the second by an unidentified typist, TS4. These sequences are distinguishable by their differences in pagination and by minute differences in their typists' styles. Collation demonstrates that TS2 and TS4 were both copied independently from the recently revised TS1, not one from the other. Both TS2 and TS4 originally began with the random extracts text, but both omit the early attempt preface written for it. TS4 includes the other three-part preface and four of the Florentine dictations, John Hay, Notes on Innocents Abroad, Robert Louis Stevenson and Thomas Bailey Aldrich, and Villa di Quarto, and TS2 originally did so as well. But only parts of TS2 for these early texts survive. Gaps in it, shown by missing page numbers, cannot always be certainly reconstructed, but all surviving evidence shows that the missing pages were identical in content to those of TS4, which is the only complete record of these initial elements in Clemens's plan. This conjecture explains why the page numbers for the January to August 1906 dictations in TS2 and TS4 are different from each other and consistently higher than the page numbers of TS1 for the corresponding dictation. TS1 begins with the autobiographical dictation of the 9th of January, having been started before Clemens decided to include any of the early material. We now understand why there are often 2, 3, or even 4 nearly identical typescripts for the January through August 1906 autobiographical dictations. The resolution of this first part of the textual mystery shows, among other things, that TS1 is the primary source for the text of those dictations, and that when parts of TS1 are lost, the missing text can be reliably restored from either TS2 or TS4. Because they were created by copying TS1 before the losses occurred. Our understanding of the typescripts also helps to explain the multiple inscriptions on so many of their pages. They are the traces left behind by the editors and typists who collaborated with Clemens in 1906 to 1909, and by the editors who published parts of the autobiography after his death, from Paine to Devoto. The 4 typescript pages reproduced in facsimile illustrate some of the many hands that had to be identified, and above all, distinguished from Clemens's own hand. The facsimiles can be seen at www.marktwainproject.org and at www.blackstoneaudio.com on the product description page. The North American Review, August and September 1906. To recapitulate, by the 21st of June, Clemens had read through and corrected all of TS1 that Hobby had so far typed, over 900 pages, probably through the dictation for the 20th of June 1906. He had reviewed his earlier manuscripts and selected at least those he wanted to begin with. He would later select several more, inserting them in later dictations. And he had written the title page and the several prefaces to frame those early pieces and introduce the 1906 dictations. Hobby began to create TS2, and an unidentified typist started TS4, probably as soon as Hobby made the revised TS1 available. With all that in train, Clemens left Dublin on the 26th of June to be away for a month in Boston and New York City, occasionally visiting Henry Rogers at his home in Fairhaven, Massachusetts, and joining him on his yacht, the Kanawha. Following Rogers's advice, he met several times with the Harper executives and lawyers in order to resolve their mutual disagreements about the recent republication of Mark Twain's Library of Humor. While in New York, he also met with S.S. McClure and left with him some pages from the dictations about Susie, probably those of the 2nd to 7th of February. McClure wrote Clemens about them on the 2nd of July. "This is not a business letter, it is a love letter. I read the wonderful chapters of your autobiography. All are wonderful, but the chapters about the dear, dear child are the finest I have ever read in literature. I wept and loved and suffered and enjoyed. These chapters should be issued soon in a little book. It would be a classic for 1,000 years, and it could later be published in the large book. I am off to Chicago tomorrow and back on the 9th. I wish I could print this wonderful thing in McClure's magazine. It would civilize a nation. It will uplift the Sunday press." Finally, with Harvey's return from England in mid-July, the troublesome Library of Humor problem was resolved, and Clemens was able to return to Dublin on the 25th of July. Clemens had already published several essays in Harvey's North American Review, "To the Person Sitting in Darkness" and "To My Missionary Critics," 1901, as well as his satirical commentary on Christian Science, 1902 to 1903. His first impulse had been to sell Harvey selections from the autobiography to go into Harper's Weekly, which Harvey also edited, a much more widely read journal than the Review. But when Harvey finally made the twice-postponed visit to Dublin, arriving late on the 31st of July, he had big plans for the Review. He promptly immersed himself in the autobiography, and by the time he left Dublin on the 4th of August, he and Clemens had agreed on what would become a 16-month series in the Review. "I like this arrangement," Clemens confided to his friend Mary Rogers, Henry's daughter-in-law, even as Harvey departed. "And so will Mr. Rogers, but he didn't much like the idea of McClure's newspaper syndicate, and I ceased to like it myself, and stopped the negotiations before I left New York." As Clemens wrote to Clara on the 3rd of August, he was impressed by Harvey's great plan. to turn the North American Review into a fortnightly, the 1st of September, introduce into it a purely literary section of high class, and in other ways make a great and valuable periodical of it. He was also clearly flattered by Harvey's response to his text. He was always icily indifferent to the autobiography before, but thought he would like to look at it now, so I told him to come up. He arrived 3 days ago and has now carefully read close upon 100,000 words of it. There are 250,000. He says it is the greatest book of the age and has in it the finest literature. He has done some wonderful editing, for he has selected 5 installments of 5,000 words each, and although these are culled from here and there and yonder, he has made each seem to have been written by itself, and without altering a word. At 10,000 words a month, we shall place about 110,000 or 120,000 words before the public in 12 months. Tomorrow, Harvey will carry away 1 full set of the manuscripts to Howells and get him to help select installments. I can't do the selecting myself. The installments will come to me in galley proofs for approval, but I guess I will pass them on to you for final judgment after I have examined them. Not only did Harvey carefully read close upon 100,000 words of the autobiography's 250,000, but by the time he left Dublin on the 4th of August, he had read the remaining 150,000 words, encompassing the pre-1906 material and all the dictations through the end of June. A composite typescript, TS3. Harvey's wonderful editing was exactly as Clemens characterized it. He selected excerpts and patched them together to create 5 installments, essentially without altering a word. Domestic anecdotes were a principal theme. He used the moving description of Olivia and of Susie and her death, with nearly all the excerpts from Susie's biography of her father that were quoted in the February and March dictations. Other favored topics included Clemens's amusing misdeeds, such as his swearing about the missing shirt buttons, Susie's charming eccentricities of spelling, Clemens's puzzlement over the spoon-shaped drive, and the challenges of the burglar alarm at the Hartford house. Harvey also included the recollections of Hannibal, such as the story of Playing Bear, from Scraps from My Autobiography, from Chapter 9, which Clemens had omitted from his plan for the autobiography, the dreadful anti-cholera Painkiller, and Orion's 3 a.m. call on a young lady. Harvey did not share Howells's squeamishness about Orion climbing, by mistake, into bed with the middle-aged maiden sisters, as they were called in the North American Review text. He included that episode without apparent concern. He rejected material with less broad appeal, such as the death of Patrick McAleer, the Clemens's beloved coachman, and omitted Clemens's excursions into political commentary, the massacre of the rebellious Moro people in the Philippines, and the treatment of Mrs. Morris, who had been thrown out of the White House. Harvey's penciled notations on the typescripts, such as Begin, End, and Continue, show that Clemens's own participation in the selection process was probably much smaller than has previously been supposed. Since Harvey drew each review installment from several different daily dictations, Hobby was now charged with creating yet another typescript to serve as printer's copy, working under high pressure to get it ready in time for the first chapter of the series in the issue slated for the 1st of September. This composite typescript, called TS3, was typed from the start with a carbon copy and was paginated independently of the 3 other ongoing sequences. Hobby managed to complete 2 batches of TS3, of some 2 dozen pages each, in time for Clemens to revise them lightly and give them to Harvey when he left Dublin on the 4th of August. She immediately set to work typing a 3rd large batch of TS3, 63 pages, which Clemens agreed to send off as soon as finished. These 3 batches of TS3 were intended for installments 1 to 5 in the review. Because TS2 had at that time been completed only through the 12th of February, Harvey also asked that the copy of complete dictation beginning with February 13th as it proceeds be forwarded to him. Clemens soon revised and returned the proof for the 1st installment, first to Clara for her approval and then to the review editors. But no sooner had he done so than a new decision was made. An excerpt from the first half of My Autobiography, Random Extracts from It, the text that he had just recently chosen to begin the autobiography, would now lead off the series. It has not been discovered who made this late change or why, but by the end of August, Clemens had read galley proofs for this Virginia Clemens installment, as he called it in a letter to Mary Rogers. The first issue of Chapters from My Autobiography appeared on the 7th of September, accompanied by a statement that would be repeated before each installment. Prefatory note. Mr. Clemens began to write his autobiography many years ago, and he continues to add to it day by day. It was his original intention to permit no publication of his memoirs until after his death, but after leaving Pier No. 70, he concluded that a considerable portion might now suitably be given to the public. It is that portion, garnered from the 250,000 of words already written, which will appear in this review during the coming year. No part of the autobiography will be published in book form during the lifetime of the author. Editor N.A.R. In the editor's diary section of the same issue, Harvey let go all holts, as Clemens might say, in an announcement of the upcoming series. The proverbial irony of fate was never more clearly marked than by the fact that the life of the world's greatest humorist has consisted of a succession of personal tragedies. But in his breast there lived a spirit which rose triumphant over all depressing emotions and still continues, after half a century, to make joy for more millions of human beings the world over than any other now existing. An attempt, even by one accomplished in the art, to analyze the character of this unique human genius would be futile. Its phases are too multifarious. There is humor preeminent, wit unexcelled, philosophy rare if uneven, repugnance, often violent to wrong in any form, instinctive and invariable, though occasionally ill-timed, revolt against oppression of humanity, whether by God or man, all supplemented by the reasonableness of a comrade, the kindliness of a friend, the devotion of a lover, and the sweetness of a child. It is a wonderful autobiography that he is writing, wonderful because of the variety of experiences it depicts, wonderful because of its truth, its sincerity, its frankness, its unhesitating and unrestricted human feeling. We have read perhaps a quarter of the million of words which will finally be written, and are convinced that a life story of such surpassing interest was never told before. Reading the above in proof, Clemens facetiously professed himself troubled, and suggested to Mary Rogers that she write a letter of protest to Harvey, even providing her with a text. She was to say that Harvey's prodigal, even extravagant praises sounded cold and indifferent to him. He is almost morbidly fond of compliments, and he realizes that these are good ones, but thinks they are overcautious and thin. When we of the family butter him, we do not do it with a knife. We use a trowel. Harvey's first round of selections, the second through sixth installments, appeared in the review between the 21st of September and the 16th of November. According to Clemens, during his August visit he had actually earmarked a total of 24 selections, a year's lot, drawing on the dictations of January, March, and April 1906, John Hay, and the second part of the Random Extracts sketch for installments 7 to 8 and 10 to 13, published through the 1st of March 1907. Later material from the dictations of October 1906 through February 1907 began to appear in installments 14 and 15, published on the 15th of March and the 5th of April 1907. Hobby made only one additional batch of TS3 for installment 16, published the 19th of April 1907. Apart from the dictation of the 21st of May 1906, My Experiences as an Author, which had been used in installment 2, no material from the dictations of May through August 1906 was published in the review. In those months, Clemens dictated some rather stringent comments about religion, business, and various of his associates, comments he had no intention of publishing during his lifetime. Besides, there were soon so many excerpts stockpiled that the making of further selections could be safely postponed. This basic workflow remained in place for the next 16 months. Clemens continued to revise his typescripts, censoring or softening them as needed. For example, he deleted the phrase "Stud Williams" was his society name, altered "Plasmon Thieves" to "Plasmon Buccaneers," changed his description of Dr. Meredith's two ripe old maid sisters to Dr. G's two middle-aged maiden sisters, altered a dying parishioner to a fictitious ailing parishioner, and deleted God Forgive Me. The revised typescripts were sent to the review and marked for house style by editor David A. Monroe. After typesetting, the typescripts were returned to Clemens along with the galley proofs ready for correction. The editorial relationship was easygoing. Monroe and Harvey offered very few substantive revisions, and Clemens often took a joking tone in his responses. He occasionally addressed remarks to Monroe in the margins of the printer's copy or the galley proofs. Pressing matters might be handled by mail and telegram, and conceivably by telephone. Critical Reception and Sunday Magazine, 1906 to 1908. Between September and December 1906, brief excerpts from the early North American review Chapters from My Autobiography appeared in several newspapers, accompanied by a scattering of complimentary remarks. The New York Times, for example, reprinted the passage from the first installment, excerpted from My Autobiography, random extracts from it, in which Clemens identified James Lampton as the real Colonel Sellers, commenting that the passage was noteworthy as an example of honest self-revelation. 2 weeks later, the Times remarked that the second installment, the story of how G.W. Carleton refused Mr. Clemens's first book and 20 years afterward called himself for so doing the prize ass of the 19th century, was a good story. Other reprinted passages included the Florentine dictation about Robert Louis Stevenson, the emotional descriptions of Olivia and Susie, the humorous episode about the burglar alarm in the Hartford house, and the essay about dueling. A reviewer in the Louisville, Kentucky Courier-Journal, possibly its editor, Clemens's lifelong friend and distant relative Henry Watterson, called the autobiography delightful, and while conceding that Clemens did not claim to be strictly speaking a historian, went on to correct the inaccuracies in his account of Jeremiah N. Sherrod Clemens. The Washington Post characterized the installments as filled with his gentle humor, and an editor of Pearson's magazine noted, "It is the old Mark Twain that speaks to us again, not the solemn reformer and critic whose heavy essays have so long afflicted a good-natured and affectionate public. We see him frolicking with the creatures of his fancy, stirring the dust of their droll adventures, and wagging his venerable head at their quaint sayings. And then we see him kneeling beside the graves of his wife and child, recalling their every look and word, and we forget the world's great humorist, knowing only the father, the husband, the true American gentleman." None of the notices of the autobiography found in contemporary newspapers and journals, however, offered any substantial critical commentary or analysis, and after the early months of 1907, the installments received little attention. For all Clemens's insistence on publishing the autobiography only long after his death, the excerpts in the North American Review were surprisingly important to him. Just how important became clear only when he realized how few readers had actually seen the magazine text. On the 30th of July, 1907, 9 months after the installments began, Lyon made the following entry in her journal. "Evidently, the NA Review is on very shaky legs, for the Colonel asked Mr. Clemens to wait for the autobiographical monies that are due him, to wait until the first of the year, for funds are low and he must borrow if he pays. It annoyed the King, for it is, as he says, doing business through sentimental channels, and he doesn't like it at all. And it isn't fair to the King." One result of this problem was that between the 27th of October 1907 and the 27th of September 1908, the North American Review chapters were reprinted with newly commissioned illustrations as a series in the weekly Sunday Magazine, a supplement that was syndicated in many large circulation newspapers. Harvey himself proposed the syndication, but he implied that greater circulation was his only concern, not how much money it made. Lyon noted on the 6th of September 1907 that Harvey got the King's consent, his glad consent, to syndicate the autobiography in newspapers throughout the country, and so the King will reach his submerged clientele. It will not bring him in a penny, though. If anyone gets anything, it will be the Harpers, and they will not get much, for the newspapers do not pay much for matter, no matter how great, which has been already published. It will be a good advertisement for the King's books, though. Clemens hoped that this syndication would expose his work to a very different class of readers. He was undoubtedly pleased, and he even praised his portrait by F. Lewis Mora that accompanied the first installment reprinted in Sunday Magazine. Many years later, on the 28th of October 1941, the artist John Thompson Willing, who was the art editor of the Associated Sunday magazines at the time of the syndication, wrote to an unidentified correspondent in response to a request for Mark Twain stories. "I had charge of the serial issuing of his autobiography in the Sunday magazine, a supplement to many important papers and aggregating nearly 2 million copies a week. This autobiography was first begun in the North American Review, edited by George Harvey, published by Harper Brothers. Mr. Clemens was much dissatisfied by the limited circulation of this review and so arranged for the larger distribution of the newspapers. When I showed him the initial copy of our magazine with the heading Autobiography of Mark Twain as the title, he turned to me and said, 'Barkus, you have left something out. It should have added, hitherto confidentially circulated,' referring to its having run in the review." Autobiography as Literature, 1909. Not surprisingly, in 1907 and 1908, the intensity of Clemens's interest in adding to the autobiography gradually abated. In each successive year, the number of dictations declined by half. They became briefer, and the proportion of inserted clippings and other documents grew larger. By 1908, much of what he produced for the autobiography was actually original manuscript that he labeled as dictation. When on the 24th of December 1909 he wrote that because of Jean's death, this autobiography closes here, he had in fact produced fewer than 12 new pages of typescript in the previous 8 months. In 1910, after Clemens's death, Howells reported in My Mark Twain that at some point Clemens had suddenly told him he was no longer working on the autobiography, although Howells was unclear whether Clemens had finished it or merely dropped it. "I never asked." He also recalled that at the outset of his work, Clemens had intended the autobiography to be a perfectly voracious record of his life and period, but he now admitted that, as to veracity, it was a failure. He had begun to lie, and that if no man ever yet told the truth about himself, it was because no man ever could. Of course, by 1904, Clemens had already convinced himself by experiment that an autobiography consists mainly of extinctions of the truth, even if the remorseless truth is there between the lines. And in April 1906, he had said in one of his dictations, "I have been dictating this autobiography of mine daily for 3 months. I have thought of 1,500 or 2,000 incidents in my life which I am ashamed of, but I have not gotten one of them to consent to go on paper yet. I think that that stock will still be complete and unimpaired when I finish these memoirs, if I ever finish them. I believe that if I should put in all or any of those incidents, I should be sure to strike them out when I came to revise this book." We have seen that in 1898, Clemens had been so discouraged by this insight that he temporarily decided to change the very nature of his autobiography. But there is good reason to suppose that by the time of his death he had reached a more enlightened understanding of what his or anyone else's autobiography could accomplish. In mid-1909, he was asked whether his remarks about the Tennessee land as published in the North American Review were true. "Yes," he replied, "literally they are true. That is to say, they are a product of my impressions, recollections. As sworn testimony, they are not worth anything. They are merely literature." 100 years have now passed since Clemens's death. It certainly seems fitting that his plan for publishing the autobiography of Mark Twain in its entirety should just now be recovered from his vast accumulation of papers, and that the autobiography's standing and value as literature be at last recognized. This edition, prepared by his editors, if not his heirs and assigns, relies on the eloquent evidence of historical documents to understand and carry out his wishes for this, his last major literary work. His long-standing plan to speak as truthfully as possible from the grave is no longer just a plan. And as Colonel Harvey predicted more than 100 years ago, the autobiography is being published both as printed volumes and by electrical method, a fact that would no doubt have appealed to Mark Twain's vivid imagination. Harriet Eleanor Smith, Mark Twain Project, Berkeley. Preliminary Manuscripts and Dictations, 1870 to 1905. Clemens wrote this manuscript, now in the Mark Twain papers, sometime in 1870, leaving it incomplete and without a title, but with space for one on the first page. It is the earliest extant manuscript that might fairly be called a draft chapter for his autobiography, although he did not explicitly identify it as such. He evidently planned to publish it in some way, for he changed the reference to his father's nemesis from Ira Stout to Ira Blank. The text has never been accurately published before. Albert Bigelow Paine did include it in Mark Twain's autobiography under the title he gave it, The Tennessee Land, but he silently omitted the anecdote at the end of the third paragraph, beginning with a venerable lady, and changed Clemens's description of his father as a candidate for county judge with a certainty of election to say instead that he had been elected to the clerkship of the surrogate court. Mark Twain's Autobiography, Part 1, pages 3 to 6. Neither description is accurate. See the appendix, Family Biographies, page 654. Available for download at www.marktwainproject.org and at www.blackstoneaudio.com on the product description page. Charles Nider reprinted the text from the manuscript, restoring the anecdote omitted by Paine, but adopting Paine's changed description of John Marshall Clemens. He also made dozens of his own omissions and changes, and he appended two paragraphs from My Autobiography, random extracts from it, written in Vienna in 1897 to 98. Autobiography of Mark Twain, pages 22 to 24. Clemens returned to the subject of the Tennessee land in that manuscript and in the autobiographical dictation of the 5th of April, 1906. John Marshall Clemens's land purchases and the family's subsequent sales of the land have been only partly documented from independent sources. The extant grants, deeds, and bills of sale are incomplete, but it was also the case that contradictory or inaccurate deeds often led to disputed claims. Orion Clemens referred to one cause of such conflict in a letter to his brother on the 7th of July, 1869, alleging that Tennessee grants the same land over and over again to different parties. The Tennessee Land. The monster tract of land which our family own in Tennessee was purchased by my father a little over 40 years ago. He bought the enormous area of 75,000 acres at one purchase. The entire lot must have cost him somewhere in the neighborhood of $400. That was a good deal of money to pass over at one payment in those days. At least it was so considered away up there in the pineries and the knobs of the Cumberland Mountains of Fentress County, East Tennessee. When my father paid down that great sum and turned and stood in the courthouse door of Jamestown and looked abroad over his vast possessions, he said, "Whatever befalls me, my heirs are secure. I shall not live to see these acres turned to silver and gold, but my children will." Thus, with the very kindest intentions in the world toward us, he laid the heavy curse of prospective wealth upon our shoulders. He went to his grave in the full belief that he had done us a kindness. It was a woeful mistake, but fortunately he never knew it. He further said, "Iron ore is abundant in this tract, and there are other minerals. There are thousands of acres of the finest yellow pine timber in America, and it can be rafted down Obed's River to the Cumberland, down the Cumberland to the Ohio, down the Ohio to the Mississippi, and down the Mississippi to any community that wants it. There is no end to the tar, pitch, and turpentine which these vast pineries will yield. This is a natural wine district, too. There are no vines elsewhere in America, cultivated or otherwise, that yield such grapes as grow wild here. There are grazing lands, corn lands, wheat lands, potato lands. There are all species of timber. There's everything in and on this great tract of land that can make land valuable. The United States contain 14 millions of inhabitants. The population has increased 11 millions in 40 years and will henceforth increase faster than ever. My children will see the day that immigration will push its way to Fentress County, Tennessee, and then, with 75,000 acres of excellent land in their hands, they will become fabulously wealthy." Everything my father said about the capabilities of the land was perfectly true, and he could have added, with like truth, that there were inexhaustible mines of coal on the land. But the chances are that he knew very little about the article, for the innocent Tennesseans were not accustomed to digging in the earth for their fuel. and my father might have added to the list of eligibilities that the land was only 100 miles from Knoxville, and right where some future line of railway leading south from Cincinnati could not help but pass through it. But he never had seen a railway, and it is barely possible that he had not even heard of such a thing. Curious as it may seem, as late as 8 years ago, there were people living close to Jamestown who never had heard of a railroad and could not be brought to believe in steamboats. They do not vote for Jackson in Fentress County. They vote for Washington. A venerable lady of that locality said of her son, "Jim's come back from Kentuck and fotch a stuck-up gal with him from up thar. And bless you, they've got more newfangled notions massy on us. Common log house ain't good enough for them. No, indeedy. But they've tuck and gommed the inside of there and all over with some kind of nasty, disgusting truck, which they say is all the go in Kentuck amongst the upper hunky, and which they calls it plasterin." My eldest brother was 4 or 5 years old when the great purchase was made, and my eldest sister was an infant in arms. The rest of us, and we formed the great bulk of the family, came afterwards, and were born along from time to time during the next 10 years. 4 years after the purchase came the great financial crash of 1934, and in that storm my father's fortunes were wrecked. From being honored and envied as the most opulent citizen of Fentress County, for outside of his great landed possessions he was considered to be worth not less than $3,500, he suddenly woke up and found himself reduced to less than 1/4 of that amount. He was a proud man, a silent, austere man, and not a person likely to abide among the scenes of his vanished grandeur and be the target for public commiseration. He gathered together his household and journeyed many tedious days through wilderness solitudes toward what was then the Far West, and at last pitched his tent in the almost invisible little town of Florida, Monroe County, Missouri. He kept store there several years, but had no luck except that I was born to him. He presently removed to Hannibal and prospered somewhat and rose to the dignity of Justice of the Peace and was candidate for county judge, with a certainty of election, when the summons came which no man may disregard. He had been doing tolerably well for that age of the world during the first years of his residence in Hannibal, but ill fortune tripped him once more. He did the friendly office of going security for Ira Blank, and Ira Blank walked off and deliberately took the benefit of the new bankrupt law, a deed which enabled him to live easily and comfortably along till death called for him, but a deed which ruined my father, sent him poor to his grave, and condemned his heirs to a long and discouraging struggle with the world for a livelihood. But my father would brighten up and gather heart, even upon his deathbed, when he thought of the Tennessee land. He said that it would soon make us all rich and happy. And so believing, he died. We straightway turned our waiting eyes upon Tennessee. Through all our wanderings and all our ups and downs for 30 years, they have still gazed thitherward, over intervening continents and seas, and at this very day they are yet looking toward the same fixed point, with the hope of old habit and the faith that rises and falls but never dies. After my father's death, we reorganized the domestic establishment, but on a temporary basis, intending to arrange it permanently after the land was sold. My brother borrowed $500 and bought a worthless weekly newspaper, believing, as we all did, that it was not worthwhile to go at anything in serious earnest until the land was disposed of and we could embark intelligently in something. We rented a large house to live in at first, but we were disappointed in a sale we had expected to make. The man wanted only a part of the land, and we talked it over and decided to sell all or none. And we were obliged to move to a less expensive one. Payne published this manuscript, with typical errors and omissions, under a title he contrived for it, Early Years in Florida, Missouri, Mark Twain's Autobiography, Part 1, pages 7 to 10. The text itself shows that Clemens wrote it in 1877, heading it simply Chapter 1, omitted by Payne. Neither copied Payne's version, errors and all, but he left off the last 60 words and inserted 3 paragraphs from My Autobiography, random extracts from it, 2 after the first sentence and 1 at the end. Autobiography of Mark Twain, pages 1 to 3. It seems likely that the manuscript was the beginning, or one of the beginnings, of an autobiography that Clemens made in response to prodding from his friend John Milton Hay. See John Hay. The manuscript was doubtless part of the Mark Twain papers on which Payne drew for the biography and other works, but in about 1920, he gave the manuscript to the American Academy of Arts and Letters, where it now resides. Early years in Florida, Missouri. Chapter 1. I was born the 30th of November, 1835, in the almost invisible village of Florida, Monroe County, Missouri. I suppose Florida had less than 300 inhabitants. It had two streets, each a couple of hundred yards long, the rest of the avenues mere lanes, with rail fences and cornfields on either side. Both the streets and the lanes were paved with the same material, tough black mud, in wet times, deep dust in dry. Most of the houses were of logs, all of them, indeed, except three or four. These latter were frame ones. There were none of brick and none of stone. There was a log church with a puncheon floor and slab benches. A puncheon floor is made of logs whose upper surfaces have been chipped flat with the adze. The cracks between the logs were not filled. There was no carpet. Consequently, if you dropped anything smaller than a peach, it was likely to go through. The church was perched upon short sections of logs, which elevated it 2 or 3 feet from the ground. Hogs slept under there, and whenever the dogs got after them during services, the minister had to wait till the disturbance was over. In winter, there was always a refreshing breeze up through the puncheon floor. In summer, there were fleas enough for all. A slab bench is made of the outside cut of a saw log, with the bark side down. It is supported on 4 sticks driven into auger holes at the ends. It has no back and no cushions. The church was twilighted with yellow tallow candles in tin sconces hung against the walls. Weekdays, the church was a schoolhouse. There were 2 stores in the village. My uncle, John A. Quarles, was proprietor of one of them. It was a very small establishment with a few rolls of bit calicoes in 6 shelves, a few barrels of salt mackerel, coffee, and New Orleans sugar behind the counter, stacks of brooms, shovels, axes, hoes, rakes, and such things here and there, a lot of cheap hats, bonnets, and tinware strung on strings and suspended from the walls. And at the other end of the room was another counter with bags of shot on it, a cheese or two, and a keg of powder. In front of it, a row of nail kegs and a few pigs of lead, and behind it a barrel or two of New Orleans molasses and native corn whiskey on tap. If a boy bought 5 or 10 cents worth of anything, he was entitled to 1/2 a handful of sugar from the barrel. If a woman bought a few yards of calico, she was entitled to a spool of thread in addition to the usual gratis trimmings. If a man bought a trifle, he was at liberty to draw and swallow as big a drink of whiskey as he wanted. Everything was cheap. Apples, peaches, sweet potatoes, Irish potatoes, and corn, 10 cents a bushel. Chickens, 10 cents a piece. Butter, 6 cents a pound. Eggs, 3 cents a dozen. Coffee and sugar, 5 cents a pound. Whiskey, 10 cents a gallon. I do not know how prices are out there in interior Missouri now, 1877. But I know what they are here in Hartford, Connecticut. To wit, apples, $3 a bushel, peaches, $5, Irish potatoes, choice Bermudas, $5, chickens, $1 to $1.50 a piece according to weight, butter, 45 to 60 cents a pound, eggs, 50 to 60 cents a dozen, coffee, 45 cents a pound, sugar about the same, native whiskey, $4 or $5 a gallon, I believe, but I can only be certain concerning the sort which I use myself, which is Scotch, and costs $10 a gallon when you take 2 gallons, more when you take less. 30 and 40 years ago, out yonder in Missouri, the ordinary cigar cost 30 cents a hundred, but most people did not try to afford them, since smoking a pipe costs nothing in that tobacco-growing country. Connecticut is also given up to tobacco raising today, yet we pay $10 a hundred for Connecticut cigars and $15 to $25 a hundred for the imported article. At first, my father owned slaves, but by and by he sold them and hired others by the year from the farmers. For a girl of 15, he paid $12 a year and gave her 2 linsey-woolsey frocks and a pair of stogie shoes. Cost, a modification of nothing. For a Negro woman of 25, as general house servant, he paid $25 a year and gave her shoes and the aforementioned linsey-woolsey frocks. For a strong Negro woman of 40, as cook, washer, etc., he paid $40 a year and the customary 2 suits of clothes. And for an able-bodied man, he paid from $75 to $100 a year and gave him 2 suits of jeans and 2 pairs of stogie shoes, an outfit that cost about $3. But times have changed. We pay our German nursemaid $155 a year, Irish housemaid $150, Irish laundress $150, Negro woman as cook $240, young Negro man to wait on door and table $360, Irish coachman $600 a year with gas, hot and cold water, and dwelling consisting of parlor, kitchen, and two bedrooms, connected with the stable, free.